Let me begin tonight by expressing my appreciation to all of the members here at Congregation in Schertz. We are certainly, or I am certainly glad, no others are also, and pleased that you're having and hosting this lectureship this year. We appreciate it so very, very much, and we commend you and especially the eldership for having the foresight to do this. There are a number, of course, problems that are confronting our brotherhood, problems from without as well as problems from within. But I believe lectureships such as this are a great help and benefit and source of encouragement and edification to the Lord's church. And I cannot conceive of what would be the situation were it not for lectureships such as this. I also want to say thanks for the announcement concerning Peggy's mother. We got a phone call just after the afternoon session here at the building. She had fallen last night. She's taken some spills before. I believe she's in her 80s now. But she fell last night and hit her head on a stove, and they had to take her to the emergency room. They said she had a concussion, but they did a CAT scan or MRI or one of those things that they do, and they couldn't find any real problem. So they kept her at the emergency room and then did not admit her to the hospital, sent her home, and that's where she is right now. And Peggy's dad called and said they just indicated they needed to keep a close eye on her, but we would appreciate you remembering her in your prayers. I also want to say a special word of thanks to the Pattons, Ron and Anita. I don't know how they're treating the rest of those you speakers, but Peggy and I have just been treated like royalty. We couldn't find a better host and hostess to put us up and to put up with us, as Ron and Anita are doing. Some people just know how to live, and Ron built a great big shop on the bottom floor of where they live and then built a house on top of that. And I just, he's got airplanes, he's got an old Buick Grand Sport, and I could go on for the next hour about that. we're really enjoying our stay with them. We appreciate their hospitality. One other word of thanks, tomorrow being Veterans Day, I'd like to read you just a few lines of something Brother David Brown sent to me recently. Matter of fact, a couple of preachers sent this my way. It is the veteran, not the preacher, who has given us freedom of religion. It is the veteran and not the reporter who has given us freedom of the press. It is the veteran, not the poet, who has given us freedom of speech. It is the veteran, not the campus organizer who has given us freedom to assemble. It is the veteran, not the lawyer, who has given us the right to a free trial. It's the veteran, not the politician, who has given us the right to vote. If you're a veteran, we say thank you. Luke chapter 23. Verses 1 through 56, Luke is writing primarily to and for Greeks. He is stressing that Jesus Christ is the perfect man. He records the following main 3 points in that chapter. Number one, the examination of the perfect man, verses 1 through 25. Number two, the execution of the perfect man, verses 26 through 49. And then thirdly, the entombment of the perfect man, verses 50 through 56. Brother J.W. McGarvey, in his commentary, lists the following Jewish and Roman trials of Jesus in this order. First, there was a stage of the Jewish trial which was an examination by Annas. The second stage of the Jewish trial was when Jesus was condemned by Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. The third stage of the Jewish trial was when Jesus was formally condemned by the Sanhedrin and led to Pilate. Then number four, the first stage of the Roman trial. Jesus appeared before Pilate the first time. Number five, there was then the second stage of the Roman trial when Jesus appeared before Herod Antipas. And then lastly, there was the third stage of the Roman trial when Pilate reluctantly sentences Jesus to crucifixion. In Luke 23, verses 1 to 25, we have the examination of Jesus. This first examination of Jesus was by Pilate. Now, the three stages of the Roman trials are going to be conducted, first of all, by Pilate, and then by Herod, and then the third will be by Pilate again. This first one involves 5 points. Number one, the arraignment. Number two, the accusations. Number three, the asking and the answering. Number four, the announcement. And number five, the animosity. First of all, in verse 1 of Luke 23, we read about the arraignment. This verse tells us of the Jewish leaders and of their leading Jesus to Pilate. First, they are identified by the phrase, the whole multitude. In Mark 15 and verse 1, they are specifically identified as the chief priests with the elders and scribes and the whole council. The Rex Turner Sr. writes concerning the Sanhedrin's organization and then its jurisdiction. And he said, first of all, the great Sanhedrin was composed of 71 members. It was divided into three chambers, the chamber of the priests, the chamber of scribes, and the chamber of elders. Theoretically, each of these three chambers was composed of 23 members, thus a total of 69, with two presiding officers, thus constituting the requisite number 71. Concerning the jurisdiction, he said the Sanhedrin embraced all the phases and functions of their government, religion, and education. Unlike the American system of government with its independent legislature and executive and judicial departments, he said the powers of the supreme tribunal of the Hebrews were legislative, executive, and judicial. It was truly the Hebrews' high court of justice. And it was before this high court that Jesus, the Christ, was tried and convicted. Secondly, after the third stage of the Jewish trials, when Jesus was formally condemned by the Sanhedrin, the Jewish leaders led him unto Pilate for arraignment. That's what we're reading in Luke 23:1. Now, Matthew, in his account, identifies the person to whom he was led, saying, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. Matthew 27, verse 2. John, in his gospel, identifies the place. He said they led Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment. And then he said it was early, and they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. That's John 18, 28. Then in verse 2 of Luke 23, we have these accusations. John continues to inform us of what took place over in John 18, 29 to 32, when he said, Pilate then went out to them. Remember, they would not come in. And he said, what accusation bring ye against this man? They answered and said unto him, if he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him up unto thee. Then said Pilate unto them, take ye him and judge him according to your law. Well, the Jews therefore said unto him, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die. Back to Luke's account, this is where he simply says they began to accuse him. Now, three of their charges are then listed. They said, we found this fellow, number one, perverting the nation. Number two, forbidding to give tribute to Caesar. Number three, saying that he himself is Christ a king. Now, the first charge is false, and it is refuted by Peter's saying that Jesus went about doing good in Acts 10:38. The second charge is also false and refuted by the fact that Jesus preached that people should render, therefore, unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, Matthew 22 and verse 21. The third charge was and is true. but not in the sense in which they made the accusation. It is this charge that Jesus then discusses with Pilate. And so in verse 3, we have the asking and the answering of some questions. Now John gives us some details in his account, John chapter 18 and verse 33. He said, "Then Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus." Now the Jewish leaders, remember, would not enter into the judgment hall, and thus Pilate and Jesus are now speaking to and with one another apart from his accusers. Luke says that Pilate asked him, saying, "Art thou the king of the Jews?" John gives us an account of their discussion concerning the kingship of Christ. John 18, 34 to 38, "Jesus answered him, Sayest thou this thing of thyself, or did others tell it thee of me? Pilate answered, Am I a Jew? Thine own nation and the chief priest have delivered thee unto me. What hast thou done? Jesus answered, My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. Pilate therefore said unto him, Art thou a king then? Jesus answered, Thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice." This is when Pilate saith unto him, "What is truth?" Luke, back in chapter 23 and verse 3, simply states, "He answered him and said, Thou sayest it." Now this answer is equivalent to the answer that Jesus gave when the Jewish high priest asked, "Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" That's in Mark 14, 61. The Lord's answer was and is, "I am," verse 62 of Mark 14. This confession is referred to by Paul, who said concerning Christ that he before Pontius Pilate witnessed a good confession, 1 Timothy 6:13. Back to Luke 23. In verse 4, Pilate then makes this announcement. Jesus plainly answers Pilate's question and the Jewish accusation concerning his being a king, and that answer convinces Pilate that the kingship of Christ is not a threat to Caesar. This prompts Pilate to make this announcement to the Jewish leaders. We find it in verse 4. "Then said Pilate to the chief priest and to the people, I find no fault in this man." John records Pilate as saying, "I find no fault in him," or "I find in him no fault at all," in John 18, 38. That brings out, in verse 5 of Luke 23, the animosity of these people. The announcement of Pilate was not one that these Jewish leaders anticipated nor appreciated. Their animosity toward Jesus now becomes apparent. They were the more fierce, saying, "He stirreth up the people, teaching things throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee unto this place." Matthew gives us some more details, saying that when he was accused of the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. And then said Pilate unto him, "Hearest thou not how many things they witness against thee?" And he answered him never a word, insomuch that the governor marveled greatly. It's Matthew 27, 12 to 14. However, the announcement of Pilate had already ended this first stage of the Roman trial or examination of Jesus. Now at this point, Pilate should have released the Lord, but he apparently does not want that same Jewish animosity directed toward him, for that would not be what we would call politically expedient. So instead of releasing Jesus as he should, he sends him to Herod on jurisdictional grounds. Luke 23, verses 6 to 12, records the second examination of Jesus, this time by Herod. It involves 7 points. The hearing, then to Herod, then again the hearing and hope, and then the harassment, and then a harangue, and a hazing, and then hostilities. You'll notice, just as a side point here, I sometimes use alliteration. A fella caught me in the parking lot earlier today and started to give me a compliment. said, I appreciate your articles in the Gospel Journal. And before I could say thank you, he said, you're illiterate. I hope he meant illiterate. Anyway, in verse 6, as the Jewish leaders were displaying their animosity toward Jesus, Pilate picked up on their mention of Galilee. In other words, when he heard what they had said, and this is what we have in Luke 23:6, that when Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked whether the man were a Galilean. And upon hearing that he was, he sends him to Herod. Verse 7, Galilee was Herod's jurisdiction. And so the record says that as soon as he knew that he belonged under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod. We also know that Herod was then in Jerusalem for the Passover. The latter part of that verse 7 says, who himself also was at Jerusalem at this time. As a side note, make this point about the house of Herod. Herod Antipas was the son of the first generation founding father of what is known as the Herodian dynasty. Herod the Great ruled Judea, Galilee, Iturea, and Trachonitis from 37 to 4 B.C. You can read about that in Matthew 2, verses 1 to 21, and also in Luke 1, verse 5. This second generation Herod, upon the death of his father, became the ruler, or what is known as Tetrarch, of Galilee and Perea from 4 B.C. to A.D. 39. He's talked about in Luke 3 and verse 1. He was the second husband of Herodias, who had been previously married to his brother Herod Philip the First. When reproved by John the Baptizer for Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, and for all the evils which he had done, we are told that he added yet this above all, that he shut up John in prison. That's Luke 3, 19 and 20. Then he had John beheaded at the request of his new wife, Herodias, which request was made through her daughter. You can read about that in Matthew 14, 1 to 12, and Mark 6, 14 to 29. Jesus now comes before this Herod. We are told in verse 8 that Herod had previously heard of Jesus. Matter of fact, in Luke 9, verses 7 to 9, we read that Herod the Tetrarch heard of all that was done by him, and that he was perplexed because that it was said of some that John was risen from the dead, and of some that Elias had appeared, and of others that one of the old prophets was risen again. And Herod said, John have I beheaded, but who is this of whom I hear such things? And so he desired to see him. Thus, when Pilate sent Jesus to him for examination, Luke tells us first of what Herod had heard. Luke 23:8. When Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad, for he was desirous to see him of a long season, because he had heard many things of him. Then Luke tells us of Herod's hope. He hoped to have seen some miracle done by him. That's when the harassment begins in verse 9. Herod begins to harass the Lord with many questions. Then he questioned him with many words. But you know, Jesus had also heard and knew of Herod and had once issued a warning concerning the leaven or evils of Herod in Mark 8:15. On another occasion, he had referred to Herod as that fox in Luke 13:31-2. Thus, Luke says that Jesus answered him nothing. I like McGarvey's comment here. He said, Herod, as a sated ruler, adulterer, and murderer, wished Jesus to turn juggler for his amusement. But the Son of God had nothing but silence for such a creature. Jesus did as wisdom demands. Proverbs 26:4, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest thou also be like unto him. Verse 10 is when the harangue begins. The Jewish leaders who had accompanied Christ to this examination took this opportunity to accuse Jesus before Herod. We read that the chief priest and the scribes stood and vehemently accused him. The indication continues to be that Jesus answers neither the questions of Herod nor these haranguing accusations of these Jewish leaders. Then in verse 12, the hazing. Herod and his soldiers begin a hazing of Jesus. We read that Herod with his men of war set him at naught and mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him again to Pilate. And that leads to verse 12 concerning these hostilities. Previous to this occasion, there had been some sort of hostility between Herod and Pilate. McGarvey suggests that it may have had something to do with an incident concerning the Galileans whose blood, remember Herod was over Galilee, we read about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices in Luke 13:1. But whatever the previous problem had been, Luke now tells us that the same day Pilate and Herod were made friends together, for before they were at enmity between themselves. Isn't it amazing how that a common foe can make friends, sometimes even in the Lord's body, among those who had previously been enemies. Well, this ended the second stage of the Roman trial, an examination of Jesus by Herod. That leads to the third examination of Jesus, again by Pilate, Luke 23, verses 13 to 25. We have some 11 points here, beginning with the summons, the speech, the sentence, the selection, the seditionist, the seemly, the severity, the sentence again, the shouting, again the sentence, and the sin. First of all, Pilate had a custom that at Passover he would release to the people a prisoner of their choice. Mark 15 and verse 6 tells us, at that feast he released unto them one prisoner, whomsoever they desired. Problem was, Jesus was not his only prisoner. There was another named Barabbas, which lay bound with them that had made insurrection with him, who had committed murder in the insurrection. And so the people began to cry aloud concerning this custom. We read that the multitude, crying aloud, began to desire him to do as he had ever done unto them. Thus the summons. Apparently Pilate, at this point, concocts a scheme to release Jesus, and he issues a summons which called together the chief priest and the rulers of the people, according to verse 13. Verses 14 and 15 gives you the speech that he made to this gathered group. He said unto them, ye have brought this man unto me as one that perverted the people. Behold, I, having examined him before you, have found no fault in this man touching those things whereof ye accuse him. No, nor yet Herod, for I sent you to him, and lo, nothing worthy of death is done unto him. He emphasizes that two legal acquittals have now been rendered concerning this prisoner, one by the governor of Judea, one by the tetrarch of Galilee. But he then continues, ye have a custom that I should release unto you one at the Passover. Will ye therefore that I release unto you the king of the Jews? That's John's record in John 18:39. Matthew says, for he knew that for envy they had delivered him, Matthew 27:18. Then in addition we read, when he sat down or was sat down on the judgment seat, his wife also sent unto him saying, have thou nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. Here then is his sentence in verse 16. Pilate renders the third legal sentence, saying, I will therefore chastise him and release him. Emphasize again here that at this point Pilate should have simply released the Lord. Instead, in an effort to please the people, he sentences Jesus to scourging with the prospect of then releasing him. But in Matthew 27:20, we read that the chief priest and the elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. Back to Luke 23, verse 17, he has to make a selection. He has to do something, for of necessity he must release unto them one at this Passover or at this feast. So the governor asked and said unto them, whether of the twain will ye that I release unto you? Matthew 27:21 is where they holler, Barabbas. Again, in Luke's account, verses 18 and 19, Luke tells us they cried out all at once, saying, away with this man, and release unto us Barabbas, who for a certain sedition made in the city, and for murder, was cast into prison. All other things being equal, Pilate would like to do what is right and release the Lord. Thus we read in verse 20, Pilate therefore willing to release Jesus spake again to them. But all things are not equal. Pilate is more concerned about his political standing with the people than he is about doing what is right. And he now asks the wrong question of the people. He asked, what will ye then that I shall do unto him whom ye call the King of the Jews? That's in Mark 15:12. Here is their severity in Luke 23 and verse 21. The people answer with such severity because they've been prompted to do so by their leaders. They cried saying, crucify him! Crucify him! And thus the sentence in verse 22. He said unto them the third time, why? What evil hath he done? I have found no cause of death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. Even though Pilate had pronounced Jesus innocent three times now, he has him scourged. You can read about that in John 19:1-15. Verse 23 of Luke's account records the shouting of the people. It says they were instant with loud voices requiring that he might be crucified, and the voices of them and of the chief priest prevailed. Justice should prevail, but one reason it does not is because those who oppose it are more vocal than those who support it. May God grant his people the wisdom to know and recognize, as the wise man said in Ecclesiastes 3:7, there is a time to speak. And then also grant us the courage to do that. When Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but that rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. See ye to it. Then answered all the people and said, his blood be on us and on our children. That's in Matthew 27:24-25. Thus the sentence in verse 24, Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they required. Pilate gave his first sentence at the conclusion of the first stage of the Roman trial, stating, I find no fault in this man. He then reminded the people of this and of Herod's sentence at the beginning of the second stage of the Roman trial, verses 14 and 15. He issued a third sentence saying, I have found no cause of death in him, in verse 22. A fourth sentence said, I find no fault in him. That's in John 19:4. A fifth sentence declared, I find no fault in him, in verse 6. Again, his sixth sentence proclaimed Jesus to be this just person we read about in Matthew 27:24. Now this seventh sentence from Pilate says that it should be as they required. Pilate was a governor sent by God supposedly for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well, according to 1 Peter 2:14. But instead of praising him who did all things well, Pilate allows him to be punished by crucifixion. Pilate had already committed a number of sins in this matter when he released unto them him that for sedition and murder was cast into prison, whom they had desired. He committed another sin. Then when he delivered Jesus to their will, Luke 23:25, he added yet another sin. This is one of the reasons that we read in at least one passage of Scripture of four persons or groups of people specifically singled out as sinning against Christ when the early church made this prayer. It's recorded in Acts 4, verse 27. "For of a truth, against thy holy child Jesus, whom thou hast anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, were gathered together." Luke 23, verses 26 to 49, records the execution of Jesus. Begins with the procession to Calvary. The execution of Jesus can be divided into three separate segments. There was, number one, the procession to Calvary. Number two, the place called Calvary. And then the perfection at Calvary. The procession to Calvary involves four points: the Cyrenian, the company, the catastrophe, and the condemned. First of all, John tells us that Jesus at first bore his own cross. John 19:17. But Jesus had previously been harassed, harangued, hazed by Herod and his soldiers and the Jewish leaders during the second stage of the Roman trial. He had suffered the sentence of scourging by Pilate and his soldiers during the third stage of the Roman trials. He had just suffered a third session of similar treatment when the final sentence of Pilate had been rendered. And Jesus is evidently unable to bear the burden of his own cross all the way. And so a Cyrenian named Simon is compelled to help him. We read in Luke 23:26 that as they led him away, they laid hold upon one Simon, a Cyrenian, coming out of the country, and on him they laid the cross that he might bear it after Jesus. Then in verse 27 we read of the company. "There followed him a great company of people and of women, which also bewailed and lamented him." A great multitude of people followed this procession. Among these, a group of women who were weeping loudly, flailing themselves in anguish. You know, women were tenderly drawn to the compassion of the Savior. One writer made the point, there is no example in the Gospels of a woman treating Jesus in a hostile manner. Verses 28 to 31, Jesus talks about the catastrophe. Jesus, turning unto them, said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children." Jesus urged them to stop weeping. That's the force of the original. That is on his behalf. Rather, they should weep for themselves and their offspring. The admonition previewed a heart-breaking catastrophe that shortly was to come upon the disobedient Jewish nation as a whole. "For behold, the days are coming," he said, "in which they shall say, blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bare and the paps which never gave suck. The Lord stated that the days would come when the women of Jerusalem who were without children would be the blessed ones." And that is a very dramatic statement in view of the great honor attached to the bearing of children among the people of Israel. Barrenness was viewed by the Hebrews as a curse from God. "Then the Lord said, they shall begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us." Well, what was this impending disaster to which the Savior alluded? Without question, it was the slaughter of the Hebrew nation and the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans, which was accomplished in A.D. 70. So terrible would be that judgment that from Jehovah, that the people would much have preferred to be engulfed by the mountains, having them fall upon them. And so poetically, the people of Israel would cry, "Fall on us, cover us." And that would not be for concealment, but for a quick death instead of prolonged suffering. But the situation was not to be that easy. The suffering would be extended. The invasion of the land by the Romans actually began in A.D. 66 and lasted till A.D. 70. The siege of the city itself lasted for 5 agonizing months. It is not without significance that the conditions became so dire that Josephus records the horrible incident of a Jewish woman who, in great distress from famine, ate her own baby. Then Jesus said, if they do these things in a green tree, what shall be done in the dry? One writer said that if Israel had put such a flame to its green tree, how terribly would the divine judgment burn among the dry wood of an apostate and rebellious people that had delivered up their divine king and pronounced sentence upon themselves by pronouncing sentence upon him. Luke then informs us that in addition to Jesus, there were two other prisoners who were condemned to die with him and who accompanied him to Calvary when he talks about the two malefactors. There is a place then called Calvary where the crucifixion took place. You can read and study about the cries that were made by the Lord upon that occasion. You can read and study about the contempt that the Lord received from the people of society, from the members of the Sanhedrin, from the scribes, for instance, and others, and the charge that they placed up over his head. But there were three crosses on that hill. There was a cross of rebellion, one thief. Another thief who had joined in that rebellion then repents and asked Jesus to remember him, and the Lord said that he would. But that third cross is indeed a cross of redemption. Jesus died that we might be redeemed from our sins. We've studied at least a part or portion of Luke chapter 23, the examination of Jesus, the execution of Jesus. You can go on and read and study about his entombment. Jesus said on another occasion, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Matthew 16:24. Again he said, whosoever will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Mark 8:34. Again, Luke 9:23. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. And then in Matthew 10:38, he that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. And finally, in Luke 14:27, whosoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. May we as God's people preach the cross, for the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved it is the power of God, 1 Corinthians 1:18. May we not glory save in the cross, as Paul said in Galatians 6:14. May we weep, as he did, for the enemies of the cross. And if necessary, may we suffer persecution for the cross. May we always be looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. Thank you.